right. Good afternoon. Today is Monday, November 3rd, 2008. My name is Allison Page, and I'm here today doing a second session interview with Robert M. Lelling about his experiences at the U.S. Forest Products Lab. First of all, thank you for coming back for a second interview. And I guess I just wanted to kind of start off by just clarifying when you came to the lab. What year was that?
1942.
Okay.
September. I was hired in June.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told they couldn't let me go to work until they got the okay from Washington.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I was 3 months that I didn't have any work.
Mm-hmm. Just kind of waiting.
No, I took a part-time job delivering groceries.
Oh, okay. Just in town?
Pardon?
Just in town?
Yeah, Maple Bluff.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you started here in 42, what were some of your first impressions of the lab on the first day of the job, the first year or so? Any specific memories that stand out about that first year or so?
Nothing in particular. Everything was kind of routine then.
Mm-hmm.
It was testing specimens. In our research, we were not, in most research, you don't know what the end result's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't know either. We knew that we were supposed to test some glue bonds, put down weight in pounds per square inch.
Mm-hmm.
And we had machines, so I think we had three machines and three operators.
Mm-hmm.
And we would test, break the specimen, look at the surface. If it broke in the wood, well, that would be 100%.
Mm-hmm.
If it broke partially in the wood and partially in the glue bond, then we would have to give it either an adhesive or a cohesive
mm-hmm.
rating in percentage. And of course, the best rating would be 80-90% cohesive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I remember from our last interview session, you said that you had first learned about the lab through your wife's
grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
He worked at the Forest Products when it was located up on University Avenue mm-hmm. by the railroad track there. Mm-hmm. It was by the mining school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And from what he told you, how did you go into this job thinking about the Forest Products Lab?
Well, of course, there was a possibility of going to war, and he said that the Forest Products was going to have to expand because of the research that they were doing at the time. There was a fellow here by the name of H. Brouse, was his last name, B-R-R-O-U-S-E, Brouse. And he was working on propellers, wooden propellers, laminated.
Mm-hmm.
And he was having some adhesive problems because he used urea type adhesives that are not really good for exterior exposure, and especially in the environment that they would be taken off at one temperature and humidity and being up in the air in another temperature and humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were interested in finding an adhesive that would bond successfully to wooden laminates. So we knew that was going on. At least my wife's grandfather's name was Clark, and he said that he thought it'd be a good place for me because I was young, out of school, and going to get married, and just looking for something.
Mm-hmm.
And he suggested I go and get an interview.
Mm-hmm.
So the gentleman that interviewed me was the head of the adhesive, at that time was wood preservative Division. And it was George Hunt. So he interviewed me for the job.
What was he like?
Oh, he was quite a gentleman, very nice man, very well known in his profession. He became the director of the lab eventually for a short time. He told me that I was going to be hired, but he couldn't give me an exact date of when I could start working because I had to go through the Washington office. And, so, like I say, it took 3 months. Yeah.
And if you don't mind me asking, how old were you when you started working?
I 19, I believe, was that.
Okay. And during those 4 years, did you, were you ever up for the draft?
No.
No?
Well, I was and I wasn't. I got married. And I wasn't eligible for the draft for a couple of years. But when the United States got involved in the war, because at that time I had a child too, so I was married with a child, and that put me in a category that was lower than most people. Mm-hmm. But, I can't remember just when in the 40s, the United States entered the war, and in a couple of years later, towards the end of the war, I got a draft notice, and along with a couple other guys, Showalter was one that I went with two of Milwaukee. And I've had a sinusitis problem, and I have this left ear is all full of scar tissue and whatnot. So I didn't pass the draft. But then when I got back, Gordy Logan, who was the personnel director at that time, was a close friend of ours, and we belonged to the same church, and we did things together quite a bit, especially his wife and my wife. But he told me then, well, they never would have let me go anyhow. So.
Did you have any close friends, either here at the lab or personally, that went?
Into the
war?
Well, there was a fellow that worked with me, Kennedy, his name was, Don Kennedy. He went in, and I think that's later, I believe, he went into service too, although he wasn't working with me, but he was a close friend. Ed Meraz was drafted, but he was 4F too, so he came back. Ed Meraz and I were probably close, very close. His wife and my wife were very close. His wife had cancer of the uterus and had x-rays and it made her sterile, and she couldn't have any children. Well, about that time, I moved to the west side by the Glenbank golf course, and his wife and my wife were very close, and my wife would bring our child over to visit with Louise, and she just loved kids, and of course she couldn't have any, and it was bad. But Ed and I used to bowl together, we golfed together, we went on picnics together. We only lived two blocks. I lived on Waverly and he lived on Zurich. Henry Zing was another one that was pretty close. We went to the same church, Covenant Church. And we had all kinds of friends. I mean, we played golf and bowl with one another. Jim Grady and I bowled together and lived just within the same block on Wilson Street when we lived there, West Wilson. And, oh gosh, I can't remember. I remember all of them now, Voice, Artie Voice, and just quite a few.
And how would you describe the environment of the lab during those 4 years? What was a typical day like, and what kind of projects were people working on throughout the lab?
Well, I think I told you we were a party-going bunch.
Mm-hmm.
And very happy-go-lucky. And we did a lot of research. We pushed out a lot of good data.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the abbreviations for all of them, but they had silver culture relations, so they had a wood reserve, and they kept changing them sometimes because they reorganized and whatnot. We had timber mechanics, and we had wood identification, and we had the printing place, the editing division, the photographic division.
Mm-hmm.
All the carpenter shops and metal mechanics. I told you about all those.
Mm-hmm.
I'm probably leaving some out.
Mm-hmm.
But we had quite a few, and we were the only lab at that time. We were number one in the agencies, and they had 9 agencies throughout the United States.
Mm-hmm.
However, the laboratory, being in the situation that it was, had no senator that actually represented it, went to bat for us in Congress. And being in the Forest Service seemed to be the last agency in the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
And the Department of Agriculture was probably the largest department. And so when they got their appropriations, they went down the ladder and the lab got what was left over.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Al Hall, who was the director at that time, he spent, I would say, 80% of his time in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
trying to get on the good side of some senators that would be willing to go to bat for us.
Mm-hmm.
But we were always wanting for money.
Mm-hmm.
And they still are. You never will be able to do much,
mm-hmm.
as long as they're a part of the Department of Agriculture.
Do you think that's surprising given what the role is of the Forest Products Lab?
It is to me, but to the outside people, I'm quite willing to say that even the city of Madison doesn't know what Forest Products does. The name is kind of misleading when you say products.
Mm-hmm.
There's also another Forest Service, or it's a publishing house,
mm-hmm.
that's located in, was located in Doctors Park. A lot of people got confused. They'd go there instead of coming here.
Mm-hmm.
But when you say Forest Products, first thing they ask you is, what do you make? Well, we don't make anything.
Mm-hmm.
No, we didn't at that time. It was all research, and all we did was push out data.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bad situation.
Do you think that's changed in recent years?
It's gotten worse.
Yeah?
I went to the last meeting we had for the retirees,
mm-hmm.
and your present director, I don't remember his name, but he was saying, too, that things have changed and that their numbers here at the lab have gone down.
Mm-hmm.
And the appropriations also gone down. So
mm-hmm.
things haven't gotten any better.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of on the subject of change, how, if at all, do you think the lab changed between the World War II era and the post-war era? Was there a change here, do you think?
Well, a definite change. These are negative things,
mm-hmm.
which is not good. But I think I told you about them having to hire the minorities. The first people that came in were Spanish people. I don't know just who they all were, and I really didn't pay much attention because I was close to retirement, mm-hmm. and I wasn't really all that interested. Mm-hmm. But I know of a couple of instances where some of the secretaries had their purses either taken or stuff taken out of them mm-hmm. when they had to lock their doors and their desks. I know Rivers, who was the head of office next to mine, had a beautiful hand-carved figure of a woman, and that disappeared. Mm-hmm. There were other things, and of course we talked about it after we retired. Mm-hmm. Brian Rivers and I were pretty close, and Arnie Okunen, maybe you know him too. Mm-hmm. He worked for Rivers also later. After I retired, Arnie took my position. Mm-hmm. They said the same thing that I had felt all along, and that is, we used to be a real close bunch of people, mm-hmm. and a change in that everybody seemed to be for themselves, mm-hmm. and it's very obvious. And even more so after I retired, because Arnie stayed on, he said, well, it wasn't any better. Mm-hmm. So that definitely set in. Now that's what this group of retirees that I talked with, now how other people looked at it, I don't know. But mm-hmm. with what the bunch that I know, we all were of the same opinion. And it just kind of got dog-eat-dog. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Brian Rivers put more or less because of the way he was treated mm-hmm. by his supervisors.
Oh, really? So that changed too?
Oh, yeah. We lost our supervisors that retired, you see. Bob Gillespie was one of them. Dick Blomquist was another one. Lynn Selbo, another one. Those were all our supervisors. Mm-hmm.
Do you think did the science change in the post-war era? Did the focus of the type of projects that were going on, did that change?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It had to change because they didn't get the money from Washington, so they took money that from grants. Mm-hmm. So they worked on private projects. Mm-hmm. And I think they're still doing some of that, like adhesive stamps for the mailing, and I don't know what they're working on now. I really couldn't tell you. Mm-hmm. Something to do with paper. That was one of their better money-producing things, because the paper companies supported them. Mm-hmm. Now, I worked here for 18 years after being going through my probationary period and whatnot, and kind of after the war quieted down. My Herb Eichner was my supervisor, and we started working on non-porous materials with metals. Mm-hmm. And that had nothing to do with wood. Mm-hmm. But we were, if somebody asked you, well, how come the forest products works with the preservation and promotion of using wood, how come you guys are working with metal? Mm-hmm. Well, at that time we said, well, if a glue would glue metal, it certainly would glue wood. Mm-hmm. Well, we found out later that that's not really true anymore. Because epoxy resins, which were the primary resins that we used on non-porous materials, they cure by mixing with a catalyst. And the catalyst generates heat, which sets the primary resin. That heat also destroys the fibers of the wood, so it actually decreases the strength of the wood. So that was a no-no.
Mm-hmm. Just to kind of go back and clarify a couple of things that I noticed or had questions about from our last session. Did you attend a institution of higher learning?
Mm-hmm.
And where was that?
Well, the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
I had a course in report writing. I had a course in understanding personalities.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that would help me in a supervisory job. Mathematics. They had courses here at the university, at the lab. One of them was in electricity. I took that here. I went to symposiums, which are, but they were usually given by a company.
Mm-hmm.
And we would travel to wherever it was.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I don't know whether anyone told you, but when the war was over and the GIs came back, they were hired based upon their civil service grades. Well, us guys who were hired and didn't take a formal civil service test, we did take a test, but not that civil service, we had to take our civil service over.
Oh, really?
Well, these guys that came back had 5 and 10 points already, depending upon if they were wounded or not. So we were competing against them, and we took our civil service, and then in my case, I got a grade promotion because I got higher grade on my test.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple other guys that did the same thing. A fellow by the name of Miller did well on his test. He got a promotion too, and Soper only completed half the test. So he got called back, and but there were quite a few people that had to Gordy Logan, of course, looked at the test and the grades, and then some of them flunked.
Mm-hmm.
And he wondered why they flunked. Well, there were some questions in there that were kind of ambiguous. And if you didn't guess right, well, you got them wrong. And there were too many people, I guess, that got low grades, and he went over some of them and actually raised their grade.
Mm-hmm.
So they were eligible.
Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of different. But then we had a down, you know, and they let a lot of people go.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know whether that answers your question or not.
I guess the thing that I was trying to find out was, did you complete a degree following high school?
No.
Okay.
No, I had 2 years of college. And like I say, I thought I was going to be hired in Fisco.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't come to be, and I was quite happy after a while with what I was doing. It was more interesting. Mm-hmm. But after the war, and a couple of years later, back in the late 60s, early 70s, someplace in there, they had a personnel audit here, and found out that a lot of the technologists here were not graded properly.
Mm-hmm.
And of course we could have told them that anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
But we got grade promotions, and
mm-hmm.
that helped a lot. But I was told then at that time that both Soper and I were equivalent of a BA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So your status here at the lab was technician, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you think your experience here was different because you were a technician rather than a scientist? And if so, in what
way? In one way, the only way that it really bothered me is that I did a lot of writing. Mm-hmm. Because Eichner and I carried on almost 100% of the research. Mm-hmm. And I did most of the research, and Herb did most of the writing above the results and making reports and publishing and stuff like that. Well, most of the time, my stuff was in written form, not oral. Mm-hmm. And I would present that to Herb. Well, he would write it up almost word to word sometimes. And then, of course, we had to go through the editing department, too. And sometimes it was changed. But Max Davison was one of our head editors. And he and I went to the same church and knew each other, too. And our families were quite close. And he told me right out, he said that he should be, you know, writing reports that, and getting authorship. Well, I didn't have a college degree. Mm-hmm. And so we didn't get authorship. Sometimes we got co-author. Mm-hmm. But very, very rarely. And sometimes even Herb didn't get credit for punishment. Sometimes mm-hmm. Blomquist did it. And when we had to go to give reports to the outside, sometimes the author of the report wasn't the one chosen to give the result reports. And that happened with her quite a bit, and that was probably one of the things that we argued about. Because now over in Germany, the head of the division gets his name on every report. Mm-hmm. There's no authorship or anything like that. The guy's name doesn't appear in the report. And so that was one of the things that bothered a lot of us. And I lost my train of thought now. But anyhow, we didn't get our names on the reports. But in my case, I wrote a lot of reports and got either author or co-author. And these were library reports. Mm-hmm. And they were all cataloged. Well, when things changed and then they took the publishing away from the lab, all that stuff that was in files got tossed out. Mm-hmm. So there's no record of it.
Mm-hmm. And kind of your sentiment about this, was that a view shared by other technicians as well? Were they frustrated with the fact that they weren't getting authorship?
Well, Soper was. He definitely had some problems with it. He did later, one of the last things that happened before he retired, he did get full authorship of one report. Mm-hmm. And when he died, that report was on the table with all of his memorabilia. Mm-hmm. And he's the only one that he ever, I know how he felt, and how his mm-hmm. wife, well, his wife died before he did. But I don't know about Arnie Okunen. I don't know whether he wrote any reports or not. I'm sure he must have wrote some things. The other divisions I don't really know about because we didn't get to see all the reports and stuff like that. But I know Soper and I both felt that we should at least get co-authorship, because we did most of the work and wrote up the original rough draft of this thing, and then that was given to our supervisor, and the supervisor put in comments, and he may suggested for us to do some more research to substantiate what we put down on paper, and stuff like that. And then it went through the editor, and Max would come in and make other suggestions. We did graphs too. We had charts. It was more than just writing.
Was that the really only division between technicians and scientists? Were you all otherwise treated pretty much the same? Everybody got along, do you think?
Far enough. Bill was the youngest one coming in, and he was single. I don't think he ever did get married. I don't know. Yeah, he's dead now. But I never did get to see his or find out what grade he was in. He wasn't on the par with us. He was probably one or two grades below us. That's all I know. Now, whether he was a bona fide technician or whether he had some other title, I really couldn't tell.
Well, kind of turning more towards the work that you did, is there one project or aspect of your work over the years that gave you a lot of satisfaction? And along the same lines, is there one job or aspect of your work that was particularly challenging or frustrating? I know we talked a little bit about that, but is there anything that stands out in your mind as being particularly memorable?
Well, I have some. Of course, number one would be the coming of the FPL acid etch. And we did a lot of work. I worked 18 years on that. We etched all different kinds of clad, aluminum, L-clad, different grades of aluminum, magnesium, titanium, and steel. Stainless steel as well as iron. We worked on Comprag. I told you Stapak at the last meeting we had, and that was the outgrowth of Comprag. Stam was head of that section, and they gave us pieces of Comprag to glue, and we had to figure out how best to glue it. Because it was really a non-porous material, because it had saturated resins impregnated in the wood, and then under high pressure bonded in. But it was very brittle, and it wasn't too successful. But out of that came Stapak, and that is still being used. That acid etch is, as far as I know, still used in the automobile industry. They actually submerge large pieces of automobiles, fenders and stuff like that. Of course, nowadays, a lot of the cars are made of fiberglass and plastics. So that's kind of gone by the wayside. But in the aviation, that's mostly aluminum and magnesium, and well, some titanium now too. But they originally would rivet pieces together, and that little rivet was only maybe an eighth of an inch in diameter. Well, by gluing it, you increased the area that was being held together. So it wasn't just one spot and then a space and then another spot and a space. It was one spot, and then the space was bonded, so it all came together and made it much, much stronger. And that way they were able to come to a knife edge with the modern day aircraft in the service. A real fast pursuit aircraft has got knife edges on their wings. And the other parts, of course, that were bonded and still are. One of the things that may be interesting, during the war, the English perfected the mosquito bomber, which was an all-wood aircraft, made out of mahogany mostly. And they shipped one wing over to the lab, and it was mounted out here and subjected to heat and cold and whatnot. And we had thermometers in it that measured all of the environment that went on. And that was glued. Everything was glued together in that mosquito bomber. And it was quite successful in World War II, probably the fastest bomber that they had at that time.
What happened to the wing?
Well, we tested it in Timber Mechanics, and they cut up different pieces to test the joint. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It got destroyed that way. Mm-hmm. By the way, when I started working here, this was the only building.
Yeah.
There was no hospital, no VA hospital. Bill Elbers, who was in the carpenter shop at that time, had the house where the credit union sits now.
Oh.
That's where he lived, so he got to work every day, the poor guy. He used to be quite a bowler, and he had diabetes, and he ended up, both legs cut off, up to the hip.
Oh.
No, up just above the knee. And we used to carry him, put him in the wheelchair, and he could drink. He couldn't do anything else, but he could drink. So, and he was in the wheelchair. All we had to make sure is he didn't fall out. Poor guy, you know.
Well, kind of talking about people that you worked with, are there other people that are particularly memorable about your time here?
Oh, yeah, sure. I know a lot of people. Oh, yeah. Bob McCurtnocker, you know, we mentioned him. Wayne Hutchins was on our basketball team. He went to work. He applied for a job in Michigan, a furniture manufacturing company. And he came back and he said, God, he says, I don't know whether I want that job or not. And we went, what's wrong with it? He says, well, he says, I think this was in Holland, Michigan, if I remember right. He said, that's a dry con city, he says. They don't, you can't buy liquor down there. Well, that's a big joke, you know. But he made up his mind he's going to go to work anyhow. Well, he went there and he tried to introduce the modern adhesives to these guys, and they wouldn't have it. They're used to using animal glue in their joints, and that was the way it was going to be. You know, these old Germans, they were pretty stubborn. And he tried to show them how the newer wood bonding adhesives, melamines, and ureas, and the formaldehydes, and all different kinds, caseins. But Resorcinol was the glue of the future, because it held up under different environments and very well, but they didn't want to monkey with that. But what he had to say was, you know, he said, that city, he says, might be dry, but he says, you ought to go to their parties. He says, everybody gets tanked. They got whole basements full of booze. I don't mean that this is a drinking group, but it's one of those things. You know, Hutchins and, Miller was another one. Of course, I know H.G. Bruce was the head of the adhesive group when I started. And Blomquist was another one, Dick Blomquist. And he went down to Athens, Georgia, and worked down there. And he came back for a visit. And he says, you know, he says, I must tell you, he says, you guys, he put it, those guys there wouldn't hold a feather to you guys here, is what he put it. Because we were good, and even though we weren't graduates, we could do all the work that was necessary here. But Ben Anderson, Paul Holden, Bill Albers, Russ McCall. Gosh, there's all kinds of them. And then these three guys here, of course. Kennedy was another one. Les Flater was quite popular in the lab. He worked in timber mechanics. And we had some of the girls, Super, you see. And Paige is another one. She died. Tall gal. She married the fire chief from Madison. His name was Paige, her last name. And she took his name. And he died, and they found her laying on the floor outside her bed, and she just died there sleeping, I guess. Yeah, quite a few of the girls we know. We had a thing about Christmas. When the Christmas came around, we always had a Christmas party. Divisions had their own Christmas parties. By the way, before I started working here, I went to a lab Christmas party at Tripp Commons, is where they used to have it, at the university. And they had a band and danced and whatnot. And George Clark and his wife, Martha, and my wife, Jean, and I went, I think, two of those parties probably we started working here. So I knew a little bit about the lab. Gosh, I'm sure I'm leaving some out, but Charlie Collins in the paper, Pauly, Chuck Pauly, another one. I'm sure I'll think of more. I knew quite a few. We knew each other here. In each division, we had friends. Fred Warren is another one that was quite popular here. And what was his name? I can't think of it right now.
Sounds like a very close group.
Well, we weren't really close. We weren't as close as we were in our own division. Let's put it that way. But the divisions got along very well together. Max Davidson, of course, is another one. Another one. His brother just died here.
Well, kind of moving into your later years here. When did you retire from Forest Products Lab, and why did you decide to retire? Was it just time?
No, things weren't going so good. We had reached the end of our grade. I couldn't go any further because I had people that were just a little bit older than me that were going to retire. Bob Gillespie, I wasn't that much older than him, and so he had a PhD, and he was ahead of the adhesive section at that time, and we talked about things too, but he always said the same thing. I always got excellent on my personnel report, and he always apologized. He couldn't give me a promotion because of her. John Welch was another one in that adhesive department. He was a much older man. What they were trying to do, when a guy would get closer to retirement, they tried to get him into a higher grade so he'd get a better pension. And we knew that. But I was in Soper the same way, and we both retired at the same time. We were at the top of our grade, and we had a 1620 computer upstairs, and we plugged in some numbers, and we found out that if we stayed at the lab, that we would only be making approximately $1.25 an hour. So we could go out and beg for that. So that was one of the influences. The other influence was that my wife's mother was living with us at the time, And she had bought some property in Lodi. And her idea of retiring was to build a little shop in the main street and retire and use the shop to produce some income. She was the solid gal at the Memorial Union and could get a pretty good retirement. And she built an apartment underneath, and then instead of building the shop, she bought an older building and built the apartment underneath it and on the main street in Lodi. And she would go to garage sales and stuff and pick up mostly picture frames, bring them back and fix them up, made them real nice, mm-hmm. and put them up for sale. Well, she didn't last very long. She died when she was 68 years old. And so my wife inherited that property. Mm-hmm. And her and her brother. And her brother lived up by Wisconsin Rapids, and he didn't want anything to do with it, and so we bought him out. And then we built a store. Well, this was in our mind, you might say, and came close to retiring. And I couldn't really do any more as far as money was concerned. So I could see myself up there in Lodi and selling stuff and what we were going to sell. Well, we said, well, we don't want to work too hard. It's mom and pa shop. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a retail shop and something that we're going to sell to tourists. Well, up there, you don't have many tourists, but they come after schools out in Illinois. So we decided to have a Christmas party because they were starting to pop up those times, especially mm-hmm. in the big cities. And we went to Minnesota, and we went down to Chicago, and Illinois, a couple of places, Frankenmuth, Michigan. And we got some ideas, so we built the shop, and we planned on staying there 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then within that 10 years, my wife would have reached, 65, I think it was at that time, you could get your Social Security pension. And we based everything on that. Well, we opened the shop in June when the school let out and closed it after Christmas. Mm-hmm. And bought a motor home and we traveled. Mm-hmm. So and we did that for 15 years. We stayed there 5 years longer than we had anticipated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this store was never you wouldn't get rich there. But it paid for itself. We didn't owe it any bills or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And we had enough money left over at the end of the 6 months or whatever it was mm-hmm. to travel. So that entered my mind. And uh-huh. so I said, well, I'm going to retire on my birthday. Mm-hmm. So my birthday is May 1st, and I retired, I think, in May. I got my retirement thing. I think it's May 7th or 5th or something like that.
What year?
77.
77? Okay.
So I've been retired almost as long as I worked here. Oh, somewhere I got it. Here it is. May 6th.
Oh, wow.
34 and a half years. That's what the lab gives you.
Oh.
That's all you get.
Yeah. I think today you don't get to keep your badges.
I got two of them.
Got a spare. Well, kind of looking back on your work here, do you feel that we may have covered this already, but do you feel that your work has left a mark on the Forest Products Lab, the USDA, or even beyond that?
Well, I did until I found out that all of my work went into the trash barrel. Mm-hmm. I think that was a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. Certainly isn't saying much for what we did. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the stuff that we did is being redone. And now one of the things you were asking about, the most popular, or one of the popular, that asset thing was one of us that really is still in, being used, I'm pretty sure. But and one where I got credit, full credit for author, was evaluating Fulker non-destructive test. And that's still being done. But I had five machines that were sent to the lab, and I did all the research on it myself. And out of the five, I came to the conclusion that the Fulker machine was probably the most reliable. And this, I know up until maybe 20 years ago, that was the machine that's being used on commercial aircraft now, over the wing section to determine whether or not there's a strong glue bond. If there's a crack that shows up, they'll do a non-destructive test of it, which is putting a transducer over the area. And you have an oscilloscope, and you can look at the sine wave and determine whether or not the bond is airworthy. I know it's being used there. The other one was, I worked with Chet Ressler, who became my supervisor for a couple of years. He was a guy that Herb Fleischer, who was the director, worked with during the war. And they worked on the West Coast, I guess, and picked out spruce as being the one veneer that is usable in aircraft. Anyhow, they had a bunch of Western red cedar. It was pine. Southern pine. It was southern pine in New Mexico. And it had a poor grade of southern pine. Southern pine has a lot of branches and whatnot. And it was not usable for lumber purposes. And various companies had tried to come up with some kind of a use for that particular stand of material. And not weren't able to produce a satisfactory use for it, mostly because of cost. Well, Herb, our Chet Ressler, got this project assigned to him to see what we could do with it, and he came up with the idea of cutting the poor area out of the wood material and filling the void with a foam patch. And through trial and error, we came up with the idea that it had to be a certain density, the patch did. And because the lumber keeps changing dimensionally, and the patch had to go along with it, or it would crack and whatnot. And then after we came up with the density, then we had to go to a covering, so the patch would be covered. You couldn't see it, had a defect. And we used a paper that was impregnated, and it had different thicknesses and whatnot. And so we had to subject that particular overlay to their various environments to see how it held up and measure what dimensional changes were made. Well, Chet up and died suddenly. So I took over that complete project myself. And I wrote up all the reports, and nobody else did any of it. And I was pretty pleased about that. And I came up with 5 different reports. By that time, I was working for Leonard Sobel. And he was very pleased with my work. And in fact, there may still be some samples out on the test fence. Because I not only came up with the best solution, but found out that if we put paint on it, it would uphold even better out in the environment. So the last I looked at it, it was 3 years. No, 2 years. Been out there 2 years. And I went out and took a look at it, and it looked fine. The paint wasn't, other than being full of soot and whatnot, right? The overlay itself looked good. And one of our retirees' parties, one of the guys here asked me if I recall what I had done, and I said, well, most of it. And he said, well, Anderson Windows had asked for the report, and of course the report had been chucked. And so he said, well, he'd give him my name, but I never heard from him or anybody else after that. So I probably figured it was too expensive. It would be used on small milled works, and not on a big board or anything like that. But it could be set up in an automated system, which would reduce the cost of it quite a bit. But they had to have a market for it. Apparently that didn't come to be.
Well, kind of turning towards the U.S. Forest Service, how do you feel about having worked for or with an agency that's part of the Forest Service?
I think I already told you. I think the Forest Service should be a part of another agency, not the Department of Agriculture, simply because of the location the Forest Products or Forest Services, in the low rung of the ladder.
That's true. Well, looking back at your career, do you feel that you accomplished everything that you wanted to in terms of a career, such as goals? Did you have any goals? And I guess along the same lines, do you have any regrets about your time here?
I have regrets as far as pay goes, because during the war everything was frozen, promotions and pay. And at least that's what we were told. I could see, I lived above a couple, he worked for Badger Arnott's. Money was no object. Those people made lots of money. Farmers. After we moved to Lodi with our little store, I found out that farmers were, most of them were working at Badger Arnott's. So I regretted that. If I had to do it over again, I would have left all that and went to buy Jordan's, got the money. But I thought that the U.S. government, civil service, had a wonderful retirement situation at that time. And Gene's grandfather told us about sick leave and annual leave. And today I have no problem, as long as the pension comes. And that we have a good insurance, health insurance policy, I'm fine. But other companies have got to the point where they are trying to come up with the same type. In fact, Obama right now is saying, well, if you can't get your own health insurance, you can get what the government's got. Well, that was the one thing that we had that they didn't at that time, you understand? And we did have an annual salary, but now we worked, well, when we started working here, it was 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we got involved in the war more, instead of putting on more personnel like they should have, they made us work Saturday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
No additional pay. And then we got to put out more, mm-hmm. and we had a lot more personnel too.
Mm-hmm.
But they had so much research to do, and they were really pumping it out.
Mm-hmm.
We had to work all day Saturdays. So we were working 6 days out of the year. Out of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing we had to do, if you wanted to take a holiday off, you had to take the day before and the day after and the holiday on annual leave. That's 3 days of annual leave you were forced to take,
mm-hmm.
just to get a holiday off. And so there's things that other people didn't realize, you know. Wasn't all candy.
Did you go back to working 5 days a week after the war then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that happened, you know, they got us on a COLA situation. There was an automatic increase every year.
Mm-hmm.
There was 1 year, and I think there was two, but I know there was one. Now, we didn't get the COLA, but they said they'd give us additional money the year after. They didn't do that either. So I got a kind of a sour taste in my mouth about the government.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, since then, you hear about other things that the government really isn't all that dependable.
Mm-hmm.
They say one thing, but they do something else.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we don't have a good government.
Mm-hmm.
It just means that's the way sometimes things are done.
Mm-hmm. But in general, did you enjoy doing the science part of it?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. When I got into writing more, I like to write, and that course I took at the U helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's one thing, another thing. A lot of guys that hired had a hard time writing because the government has a definite way in which they want
mm-hmm.
the reports written, and you got to follow that. And Chet Ressler couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a report, honest to God, it was an inch and a half thick. And then Salvo wouldn't even look at it.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I haven't got the time for that. You go back and rewrite it. Well, he didn't. I ended up rewriting that report. And I got 5 reports out of it.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is just kind of a side note. Because you were here during the 70s, and I thought it'd be interesting to ask you this. Were you present on the lab around the time that Sterling Hall was bombed in 1970 over on UW campus? And
I was home the day it was bombed, and I was outside,
mm-hmm.
and I could feel it and I could hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just lived up beyond West High School.
So really close, actually, then.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened here at the lab in response? Was there a response at all? No.
Not anything unusual. Everybody was talking about it, but no, we didn't change our research or anything that I know of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were there any additional safety precautions, this being a federal agency?
Yeah. During the war, we were fenced in to a point, and down at the entrance down there, was a gate, and we had a guy, a fellow sitting down there that let people go through the gate, and you had a badge,
mm-hmm.
and that permitted you to go through.
Mm-hmm.
That was during the war.
Mm-hmm.
After the bomb, I don't think anything tightened up very much. Because from the war, it was already there.
Mm-hmm.
But we were more aware of knowing who was walking around the building, and we were alerted to be on the lookout for people that did not have a badge on, to make sure that they would go back to the front officer and get signed in. Mm-hmm. Now the door at night had a lock on it, and you had to activate that lock by a switch at the front officer or front desk. Now, I don't know if that is still being done or not. I imagine it is. But we had guys around here with the clock. You see, we had a third shift here, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we worked nights, and that's another thing. That was sometimes a volunteer, but not always. But I volunteered to work every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at night, just testing specimens. And that was the early part of my employment. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple other fellows that also volunteered to work. Soper didn't because he lived way out of town. But I could walk back and forth to work. Mm-hmm. And but again, I got no differential pay for that. Mm-hmm. We had another building that was leased by the lab uptown. Have you been told about that?
No.
Kurt Knocker should have known about that.
He may have. I talked to him a long time ago, so.
Oh. Well, we transported people up there that did work up there, and I'm not just sure what kind of work they did. Mm-hmm. Something to do with timber mechanics. But all during the war, they leased that building. And then they built the garage back here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened, we had a travel-all automobile, I guess you'd call it, that held six people. And that was used to go and get the mail, bring it here, and transport people back and forth to that building up there. Mm-hmm. We also had lab cars. But we had one of the fellows that drove that car one morning. We had five bays in that garage. He walked in one door, got in the car, and backed right to the garage door. Well, come to find out, he didn't last very long. His name was Garfoot, John Garfoot. And he was kind of a yard man. And so the guy that took his place was also a yard man. He did the same darn thing. I said to him, "You gotta leave those doors open." I don't know. It's funny things happen like that. But none of those buildings were here. They built the garage, but they had some little small garage. It wasn't where the present garage is, but on the other side. When they built that new garage, well, I can understand, man, they walked in one bay and drove out the other one.
Mm-hmm. Were those put up in the 50s, 60s, or?
Yeah, 50s, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's.
But during the 70s, I retired in 77, so I when was that bombing? I don't remember.
70.
In 70. Mm-hmm. I was working with Chet Ressler then, you know. I was downstairs then. But I was home when that went off. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the other things I did, Arnie Okunen was working with timber mechanics at that time, and he was assigned to go out to Washington, state of Washington, in the warehouse or a forest out there, and using a randomized system to pick out an area to go to, and within that area pick out a tree to go to, And within that tree, you pick out a 5-foot bolt and cut that and get it back up on the road. Most of Western Red Cedar is down low and around the creek. Mm-hmm. And so I was chosen to go with him. I had no experience, because that was out there 21 days and 17 days we had rain. And everything was wet, and I didn't have the right kind of boots with me. They were slippery, and you walk over a lot of down trees and trunks and whatnot, and limbs of trees and foliage and whatnot, and at the same time looking out for bear and whatnot. But Arnie was good at that. He could do that very well. And I was a gopher, more or less. Mm-hmm. And but that was interesting. Mm-hmm. And we only got one place we couldn't get to, and I think we sent back 26 logs. Okay. There was another crew of two guys working in Oregon doing the same thing. And I think we only missed one bolt. And we hired a sheriff to come with a Jeep that had a winch on it, because we couldn't roll that thing up over a bunch of fallen limbs and whatnot up to a road that was quite high. Now the other thing that I enjoyed doing when I worked with Brian River, he designed and got the specs for making a prototype testing machine that we were interested in knowing how much movement under a what we call a dead load, a weight on a glue joint, and with the transducer mounted between the specimen and what held it. And this machine was to measure that movement in metric inches, mm-hmm. which were more nano inches. You couldn't see the movement. We had an awful time. It was located down in the first floor, in the back. There was one room there that was like a humidity room, but it was emptied out, and we used that to mount our specimen in this machine. Oh, really? Company, I think it was in Illinois, was the one company who said they could build this machine according to Brian's specifications. And they built the machine and sent it here. And I can't think of her name. There's a gal that was helping me. And we soldered joints and whatnot and attached the solenoids and the transducers to the specimen. And we checked it out, see that it was a tight fit, whatnot, a good circuit, in other words. But anyhow, make a long story short, when we checked the machine out, why, there was something wrong.
Oh, yeah. Is this the one where you had to send it back over and over again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I enjoyed that because that was new.
Change of pace.
Change of pace, yeah. Yeah. And what I, you know, you see some numbers up on the machine, and this is the metric system. Mm-hmm. And my metric system didn't work too good up here. And so I wasn't always positive that what I was seeing is what I thought I should be seeing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't believe what I saw, in other words. Mm-hmm. And I hated to go to Brian. I didn't want to tell him, well, God, I'm still kind of fuzzy about the metric system mm-hmm. in these small dimensions, small numbers. And so he'd come back and check it, and sure enough, it wasn't working. Mm-hmm. And so we checked out at all of them. We had to go through all of the connections that we had soldered and whatnot, and they were all okay. And so we called the company, and they sent two men. They spent 2 days here. And they said that one of the potentiometers on the machine wasn't working properly, so they ordered two more. Well, the new one that they put on the machine, instead of checking it out, they went right home, because they were charging about $100 for each of them a day. That's $200 a day for those guys. Well, we didn't have to pay it. They had to pay, because mm-hmm. this machine wasn't up to spec. But nevertheless, we found out that that new potentiometer that had been supposedly checked by the guy who signed the okay didn't perform like it should either. So they took that out and put the other potentiometer that they ordered on, and it worked okay. But you had to know whether it was working or it wasn't working. And that was kind of a challenge for me. But I enjoyed it. Then after I got through with that, pretty much we had a box on top that the company also built. And that was supposed to provide a certain temperature. We could adjust it up or down, whatnot. And that wasn't giving us the right answers either. So that came from a different company. Mm-hmm. So we sent the box back to them. And we waited and waited and waited for it to come back, and it didn't come back. And finally, Brian wrote him a letter, or called him, I guess he called him. And they hadn't even checked it out yet. And the only thing they do to check it out is they put it mm-hmm. in their oven. Mm-hmm. And they know what the temperature of the oven is, and then the box should register that same temperature. Well, they found out it didn't. So they made some changes on it, and then they sent it back to us. Well, by the time we got it back on the machine and checked out the machine, and then we checked out the box, and put the specimen in it, and found out that the results that we were getting weren't right. And so where do we go from here? Yeah. Well, a fellow was working here, Evans, his name was it, and he did a lot of work at the Timber Mechanics because they used a lot of electronic measuring devices. And so we talked to him about it. So he checked it out, and there goes the ambulance. Must have had an accident up there. It's three sirens mm-hmm. went by. He checked out the box and got some ideas of maybe what it could be. So what he did, he mounted a little battery fan inside the box. Mm-hmm. That's all it needed.
All that worked for...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was almost a year before we got that thing working, right? And then after I left, then Arnie Hokanen took over, mm-hmm. and they changed the whole setup down there. And mm-hmm. it looked pretty nice when I came back for a visit and checked it out. And I guess it was doing what it was supposed to be doing. Oh, another thing, too, was mm-hmm. We found out that one of the problems was the voltage in the room. Did I write about that? It had to be a constant voltage, mm-hmm. we found out. So we had to arrange for that. And the temperature wasn't right because the janitor was opening the door at night. We had to put a lock on the door. Oh, boy, talk about. Okay. But you're measuring stuff mm-hmm. that's in, you know, very, very small numbers. And didn't take much to change it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I'm pretty much out of questions that I brought. I know that you brought a list of things that you had thought of.
Well, one of the things that that the lab did that wasn't really publicized. And that's another thing. Mm-hmm. The lab made publications, but they went to other companies that were doing the work that involved the research, mm-hmm. or went to other research agencies. But very little of it got put in the paper. The Lindbergh thing, mm-hmm. did, well, that was the big thing. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot more things. And almost daily, mm-hmm. that silver culture would get pieces of wood that were involved with some accident or killing or something like that, mm-hmm. to identify it and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that was never, you know, published. So there wasn't common knowledge of what kind of research the lab was really, mm-hmm. coming out with. And we did a lot of it. And we haven't heard much about it since I retired. Mm-hmm. Still don't hear. I don't know what you guys are doing, mm-hmm. here now. And I think that that's, you know, should be publicized. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that actually came out was we had a fellow by the name of Al Higgins here, a little roly-poly man like I am, but he used to tell stories. And he always heard the same story, but with different names. And he and Lynn Selbo used to go back and forth for stories, and they keep you in stitches. Very good. Well, Al worked down at what we call the veneer lab, and one of the things, I'm not sure whether this was a project or not. I think it was just Al's idea that came up out of the blue. But railroad ties, wooden ties, mm-hmm. are all checked and cracked eventually from the environment and different weights on it and whatnot, cracking it. And Al came up with a real simple idea of covering the top and the bottom of those ties with a piece of plywood, just gluing it down. And that was such a big savings for the trains at that time, because they replaced a lot of their ties with Al Higgins. We call it Al Higgins Cap. It's regular name. And of course, trains are going to become more numerous now, it sounds like. So they're going to have to hold those rails down some way. I don't know how, other than what they've already done. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they didn't use the Higgins cap, mm-hmm. on those ties to keep them from checking and splitting. Yeah.
So who knows? When they bring Amtrak back through Madison, maybe.
Well, if they have to redo the railroad bed, yeah. I told you about the parties in Trip Commons. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They always had little prizes. We'd go around the neighborhood and get down the corner here, across the street, was a Rent-A-Bomb's drugstore on the corner. Mm-hmm. And we had a fellow with Jim, Black. He was in the paint lab. And he walked out of that drugstore one day and went right through the front door. It was a glass door.
Oh, dear.
But there was no buildings around here, like I said. Mm-hmm. Nothing. This was out in the sticks.
Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't have all the nice intramural fields and that around. Mm-hmm.
Hospital wasn't there.
Nothing. Told you about Bill Albert's home, about Washington. The paper machine, the original paper machine, was right here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Just down the, mm-hmm. hallway.
Yep, extension of this hallway. Mm-hmm. And it was I don't know what size it was, but it wasn't full size, obviously. But when they built the new paper building, mm-hmm. and put the new machine in, that was enlarged. The machine was enlarged a little more. They had more to work with. Mm-hmm. This building, originally when I came here, was heated by two big my memory is going.
Boilers,
I guess you might say, downstairs. And I told you about the food being stored down there during the scare for the atom bomb. Well, those, I think, were fed, the boilers were oil boilers, if I remember right. Well, they decided that that was an expensive way to heat this building. This building was like a sieve. It wasn't insulated or anything like that. And so they built a new heating plant over here, and they built that with oil. And then somebody said, well, we ought to have coal. That's cheaper than oil. A fellow by the name of Miller was ahead of that. And so they changed that over to a stokerite system. And they had siding put in, rail siding. And they brought the coal cars right on that siding. And they had a like an elevator, like when the doors would open and the coal go down and to be shoved right into the burners. Well, of course, the first thing that happened in the first winter, the coal froze.
Oh no!
So they wouldn't get much heat.
So it was cold here.
And of course, with that system, it's where it froze, the coal wouldn't come out of the cars, you know. And you know, boy, that was fun. Then they changed it all over again to back to oil. No, I guess they did go back to oil burners. But then I think it's natural gas now. That was a lot of fun. We had no air conditioners. And at first, but then later on we got the winter jobbies. And they were made plans to air condition the whole building, central. I think it is air conditioning, isn't it? All central?
Some of it. For instance, this room is still window unit.
Yeah. So. But I know the new buildings are central air, but this place was hot.
I can imagine.
Well, it's all pretty much concrete then. And we had to take out war bonds during the war.
Oh, yeah?
And, of course, we were on a fixed income. When we take out war, we had one bond pay period. That's a lot of money. But we went for the effort, you know. Yeah. Well, those are the extra things that I thought of. There's going to be some more stuff, too, I suppose. But.
Well, I would like to thank you then for taking the time to come back and talk with me some more.
Yeah, well, you get the things you need. When they had the 50th anniversary, we had set things up down in the veneer mill, and we had people coming through. And I had projected on one of the big presses down there, I had a paper mache type of space vehicle that was all glued together.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that was kind of a conversation piece. And, But, we had vats down there where our stainless steel. We did a lot of work with corrugated aluminum. That the aluminum faces or surfaces on the wing are held apart by corrugated aluminum. And of course, that doesn't have much surface to glue onto. So we did a lot of work. Well, we used the back part of the veneer mill to set up these big vats of sulfuric acid and dichromate to submerge these corrugated pieces. I think they were 30 by 30. And
I think they were some quarter inch thick and some of them a little thicker than that.
Mm-hmm.
Back there. But that was a job that I had to do.
Oh, yeah?
And that was a messy job. And some of my clothes got kind of holy. And another thing we had to do early on when I was working with Ike, Eichner, the university had people that were working with chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the lab was working with chemicals of one sort or another. And go to the university and get shots for,
mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was, but they gave her a shot. And Herb was afraid of a needle. And he says, I'm going funny. He says, if I start fainting, you have to grab me.
Did you have facilities set up for, in case there was some sort of incident with chemicals?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But not like it is now.
No.
You've got these water fountain things that for eye washes. We didn't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time you want the soaper. And he'd wash out your eye and or wherever you need to take care of it. I had mercury. I had a thermometer that fell and broke. And that room was off limits all the rest of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it was contaminated. And they came in with baking soda and I don't know what else to decontaminate it.
Well, thank you.